But you've never had a situation where the leader of the State Department basically seems like he doesn't believe in core things that the State Department does, or won't even spend resources that have been appropriated by Congress. I think that is a level of demoralizing that is pretty new.
Welcome to Foreign Policy. I'm Sharon Weinberger, Executive Editor for News, and you're listening to the ER. I'm in Washington today, and I'm joined by Vikram Singh and Robbie Grammer. Vikram is Vice President for National Security and International Policy at the Center for American Progress. Prior to joining CAP in 2014, Singh served at the State Department as the Deputy Special Representative for Afghanistan and Pakistan, and at the Pentagon as the Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for South and Southeast Asia. ER nerds, we love hearing from you. If you have episode ideas or comments, you can email us at erpodcast@foreignpolicy.com. So in recent days in the office, we've been following the trials and tribulations of Rex Tillerson over at State Department. And one of the questions that came up, Robbie, was where was Rex during the North Korean crisis, and particularly over the weekend? Can you tell us a little bit about how that question came up and what the answer was?
Yeah, so obviously, anytime North Korea conducts a nuclear test, it provokes a flurry of activity and condemnation from the international community and U.S. administration. This time was no different, with Trump sharply rebuking it and Secretary of Defense Mattis, you know, making veiled threats. But in the midst of this, there was some deafening silence coming out of America's diplomat in chief. And Secretary of State Rex Tillerson was, turns out, in Texas for the weekend. As a native Texan.
You say it turns out. I mean, meaning we didn't know where Rex Tillerson was.
There was a bit of a process of me finding this out. And essentially, you know, outside of one tweet from a pretty prominent reporter last week, citing anonymous officials saying he was going to Texas, no one really knew where he was. And this includes press people I spoke to. It also includes, some senior and mid-level officials I've spoke to over the weekend to try to figure out where he was, just because his absence was conspicuous. I mean, to be fair, you know, he's possibly America's quietest modern diplomat in chief in history. But he was talking to, you know, all of his counterparts behind the scenes, you know, on the phone, which is sort of his MO. But it is very interesting that there were no public statements or remarks from him through the entirety of the crisis.
The idea of the stories, we actually just started wondering, you know, we were looking at the statements coming from Nikki Haley, from the Pentagon, and we just didn't see anything from Rex Tillerson. But for us, it struck us as abnormal. It was just weird that there was no statement from Tillerson and we didn't know where he was. But maybe, Vikram, is that fair? I mean, was it abnormal in your view?
I don't think you could find an example of a similar crisis where you didn't have any comment by the Secretary of State in recent years, maybe ever. It is quite surprising. Even if they're away on vacation or something like that, normally they would have somebody come up with a statement and say, like, yeah, that looks good, and get it out there. I mean, it's not a difficult thing to do, to issue a statement. And it's kind of one of the number one jobs of the Secretary of State is to express to the United States, the American people in the world, where the United States stands on an issue. So I think it's a pretty stark either overshadowing of Rex Tillerson, or it speaks to something else about his not choosing to play the role of our chief diplomat.
Then what? I mean, it's somewhat speculation, but it is very striking. I mean, what do you think is going on? Because we heard in the last few weeks and months that, you know, Tillerson and Mattis have a relationship. I mean, that there are all these relationships and things going on. I mean, what would you speculate are the conversations that go on that we simply had this quiet from the State Department? So
there's nothing stopping the Secretary of State from putting out a statement.
Okay.
The Secretary of State isn't going to be like, hey, White House or Pentagon, can I put out a statement? So if he wanted to put out a statement, he could put out a statement. He could have gotten a message that he should stay quiet and we've got this. I don't know if that was something that was conveyed, but, like, you know, normally you don't see sort of any hesitation on something like this that's so obvious. This is not like rocket science here. This is basically like, this is bad and we stay resolved and we stand with our allies. It's pretty, you know, these
the situation kind of writes itself. Exactly. You know, I mean, it's in North Korea. It's not like you have to worry about offending them.
Yeah.
I
mean,
right.
Yeah.
You don't have to worry about offending anybody. You don't have to worry. And it's highly unlikely that he would say something that would be, you know, farther than the administration wants to go, since it's the president who's always being the one who's like out there in, you know, in the land of sounding dangerous. It could be that he got tired of being contradicted by the president when he would make statements about diplomacy.
So he's just not going to make any
and
statement.
And the president would make statements basically saying, no, you know, that's they only understand one thing. And then you'd get the, you know, or the fire and fury, you know, and he tries to walk things back. And then it's, you know, the president doubles down. And so it could be that he's just like, why am I making statements if I'm going to get contradicted by the boss?
Well, it's funny. You've seen institutions, you know, under this administration kind of going up and down. I mean, there was a lot of tumult on the National Security Council. Then there was sort of an exodus and things seem to have quieted down a bit there. The Pentagon seems to be on track. We've written a lot about just even the bureaucratic problems, the administrative problems at State Department. I mean, we're sort of running out of headlines. Like, what's another word for exodus when we were describing some of the resignations? You know, Robbie, how much are these resignations of these high-level officials? I mean, part of it is this is what happens when a new administration comes in, but it does seem like it's a lot more. What is the benchmark and what's driving these resignations?
Yeah, and I mean, I think it's a couple of factors. The first is the president himself. President Trump is not like other modern presidents in how
in so
he,
many ways.
In so many ways. And I think that does eat away at America's diplomatic corps in some form. As a second factor, I think there are a lot of really experienced veteran diplomats who are nearing the end of their tenure, you know, nearing the age of retirement. And some I've spoken to some of their colleagues, some who are still in, some who are out, who just said, you know, I was going to retire in a year or two or three, but I just can't handle this administration. And a third is that there's really low morale at the State Department. That's something you hear, I think, in every administration, that morale at the State Department is low. It's sort of a constant, but it's like this time they really mean it.
Right.
And I think that's really eating away. And then, of course, there's the Secretary Tillerson's overall redesign of the State Department, where he's talking about shaking things up, about hiring freezes, about culling top levels to help save money. And I think that's, you know, created a lot of discord, a lot of uneasiness, a lot of, you know, well, I might as well get out now, take what retirement package I can before things get worse.
I don't think you've seen ups and downs at the State Department. I just think you've seen downs and downs. It's sort of an axiom of government that a cabinet secretary, defends his or her agency. That is one of your jobs, right? And so you'll oftentimes hear people criticizing a secretary of defense for pushing for yet more defense spending. But it would be really odd and probably seen as a dereliction of duty to not be pushing for resources for your agency. It's one of the reasons you can't have the Pentagon credibly argue for the State Department's budget, because their job is to do the Pentagon's budget. And so even if they want a strong State Department, that's not going to be what carries the day. So the fact that the Secretary of State is basically cooperating in the gutting of the State Department, I think is sort of a kind of signal that it's unprecedented to have. There's plenty of people who've worked on reform and streamlining efficiencies. You know, secretaries of state have had to manage reductions in force and actually, you know, shrinking budgets in hard times, including after the Cold War. There was, you know, a shrinking of a lot of things in the United States government. The elimination of the U.S. Information Agency was, you know, I imagine very traumatic for people who had been in that organization. But you've never had a situation where the leader of the State Department basically seems like he doesn't believe in core things that the State Department does, or won't even spend resources that have been appropriated by Congress, for example, on countering violent extremism. The story about, you know, the $70 or $80 million for countering violent extremism work that they just decide, well, we're not going to do that. I think that is a level of demoralizing that sort of is pretty new. And so I think a lot of senior people are sort of choosing between, do I stay and try to help preserve, or, you know, have I fought my fights for the day? And it's probably going to be the slightly, you know, not yet at retirement age stars that choose to stay that are going to be the people that provide some sort of backbone and the resilience for the State Department to sort of come back. But in the meantime, we're cutting off capabilities that we actually desperately need. The fact is that international relations happen. Meetings continue to happen. Summits continue to happen. Vladimir Putin's flying around meeting with our allies in the region. And and we should have a team out there. I mean, honestly, the Secretary of State or an Assistant Secretary or an Undersecretary or a Deputy Secretary should be meeting with his Japanese and Korean counterparts right now. Or basically, we should have like a constant presence.
Yep. What is Tillerson doing now? I mean, so he was in Texas for the weekend, but the weekend's over. I mean, there's another hurricane coming, but is there, like, what's on his agenda right now?
Well, he's currently meeting with the Kuwaitis today, actually doing this U.S.-Kuwaiti strategic dialogue, I think they call it, which is diplomatic speak for our leaders meet and right. hash out a few communiques. That I think most of the focus on that will be on this sort of festering Qatar crisis. And that's another issue that it's actually one of the few issues that Secretary Tillerson has really been out in front. And as public as he is, public on it, we really want to solve this Qatar crisis between Qatar and its neighbors. And yet there hasn't really been any significant progress made there. The United States has sort of ceded its negotiating role to the Kuwaitis as sort of the quote unquote Switzerland of the Gulf to moderate this in an unbiased fashion. And, you know, some experts I've spoken to said that's a really prudent and smart move. Dare I use the adage leading from behind, but that might be brought up there. And then others have said, no, we need the United States going in and knocking heads together and saying, sort your shit out because we've got a lot on our plate in your region and we really need your help.
And also Tillerson's been contradicted by Trump, if I recall, on
yes.
that.
What
exactly happened?
I mean, Tillerson went through a week or so of shuttle diplomacy in the region, you know, trying to play the unbiased mediator. And a lot of it was unwound by one or two classic Donald Trump tweets in which he said something akin to, see, I asked Qatar to, or I asked the countries to stop funding terrorism, and look what Qatar is doing. Like, you
and
know.
That was sort of the end of Tillerson's
yeah.
quiet diplomacy on
well,
that.
I mean, the thing this is basically a self-inflicted crisis. I mean, the Gulf states believed after the president's big, beautiful trip that
beautiful. With
that
the magic
had,
orb,
with the magic
that
orb, that they had essentially a green light to get tough on Qatar, which is something they've wanted to do for a long time. And they took that and they ramped up the pressure big time and they sparked this major crisis in the region. And when Rex Tillerson tried to basically say, no, we didn't mean that, the president then said, well, no, yeah, we did mean that. And so, you know, this is the kind of thing that will be very hard for Rex Tillerson to undo, because I think when the head of state has weighed in the way the president has, it's going to take the head of state to basically unring that bell and convince the GCC countries that, no, we really are serious, that you need to figure this out.
Well, if you look at what Tillerson is doing, so if we say that probably he's not going to be playing a prominent role in the North Korea crisis, he didn't play a prominent role in the Afghanistan decision. If you look at these things that his legacy probably he thinks would be organizational, but now we have Congress pushing back as well. Mm-hmm. That is probably the one area that he and Trump agree on, is the reorganization and cutting back of State Department. So what happened in Congress this week?
Well, in the Byzantine world of appropriations, the Senate Appropriations Committee passed a bill that really repudiated Trump and Tillerson's plans to cut U.S. Diplomacy and foreign aid funding. And it added, I think, $10 billion above what Trump had initially requested.
Because they were going to do a 30% cut.
About a 30% cut to State Department, USAID, and foreign operations. And they added $10 billion instead, including a lot more funding allocated to disaster relief than the Trump administration had planned. So first, there was a repudiation on that front. And on the second element of this that's really interesting was there was a what's known as a management package that the Appropriations Committee pushed through that had a series of amendments in it that were passed unanimously that actually curtailed Tillerson's plans to redesign the State Department in a few ways, such as cementing in the or securing the PRM Bureau, which is the Population, Refugees, and Migrants Bureau.
Which was going to be eliminated, right?
Yeah, yeah. Okay. And it was reported earlier this summer that the administration was mulling folding that into the Department of Homeland Security, which a lot of State Department people said would be a horrible idea. And the second thing is it actually cut off Tillerson's plans or reported plans to expand the Policy Planning Office, which is sort of the in-house State Department think tank that's been growing in power and scope under Secretary Tillerson. A lot of people are worried that it's sort of become a mini department within a department and without any Senate oversight. And so some see this as a big congressional check on Tillerson's aims. Others see this as unprecedented congressional micromanagement over the Secretary of State's purviews. But that debate is still being played out.
What do you think? I mean, this will. I mean, what is then the strategy for the administration? I mean, if it sounds like there's not much support in Congress for Trump and Tillerson's plan, so what?
There's no support in Congress for the budget that they put forward, and so it could be that they're just sort of playing a game of like, look, we're going to propose preposterous levels of cuts, and you guys will come back with less cuts, but it'll still result in some of what we want to see happen. Mm-hmm. I think that on reorganization, I actually think Tillerson could have had a very sympathetic Congress on streamlining and reorganization of the State Department.
There's plenty of
improvements that could be made. But to do that, he would have had to say, I'm looking at the previous, work of previous secretaries of state on this. So there have been quadrennial diplomacy and development reviews that have made a lot of recommendations, many of which haven't been followed through. He would have had to say, I'm, engaging with the department and I'm getting recommendations from outside experts and I'm coming to the Hill and talking about what we found and we're going to come up with a plan. And then that plan is going to be what we start, what we get behind in terms of budgeting and making reforms. If he had done a normal process that involved Congress, I think he would have had some sympathy. I don't think he would have found a lot of sympathy on big cuts. I mean, the fact is, if you look at all of the national security challenges the United States faces, none of them are due to insufficient military spending. That is not our problem for the last 17 years. It's just not, And so, at the end of the day, even members who are very bullish on more defense spending, they don't somehow think that should come out of cutting development and diplomacy.
Also, it's sort of pennies compared to.
And it's right. You can't cover it. I mean, so the proposed Trump administration plus up in military spending is the equivalent of the State Department, right? So so you can't cut enough to cover that. But it's a really interesting tension, and it comes at a very critical time for the United States. If you think about it, as we invest in the military, the Russians, the Chinese, they're investing in military capabilities too, but they're kind of eating our lunch in a lot of non-military arenas, in just the things that development assistance or proactive diplomacy or information operations, just those arenas. So, right, the Russians are directly targeting us with propaganda and information operations and bots and troll farms on Twitter and Facebook. Those capabilities, the United States relies on its civilian tools of power to deal with those kinds of things, and cutting it is these tools right now is really the height of irresponsibility. I mean, we are leaving ourselves open in a lot of areas, and we're investing in things that I think the Russians and Chinese are quite happy to see us invest in. Go ahead and plus up your military budget. That's great because we're competing in a totally different space.
Not looking good. Well, let's talk about the Rexit rumors that come and go, that Rex Tillerson might be leaving. And so the latest iteration of this rumor is that he will leave and be replaced by the U.S. ambassador to the U.N., Nikki Haley, who was very prominent during the North Korea crisis and who earlier this week in Washington, D.C., that she seemed to lay out what Trump has been advocating for, which is possible decertification of Iran and the nuclear deals. So once again, people are talking about, Rex Tillerson could be on the way out. Nikki Haley could be on the way in. What do either of you think of that? Is that a likely possibility?
I think, like many reporters, have been pulling my hair out trying to run this down. I think sometimes in D.C., a rumor can take root and become this self-perpetuating cycle.
Because once you report it.
Because once it's reported, people talk about it. Then more people talk about it, right. So people report on it. No. So it's really hard to distinguish between what's there and what's, not there, or what's sort of a mirage. And I think why it sort of kicked up a little bit again this past weekend is because Nikki Haley became the administration's most prominent diplomatic voice, both on North Korea and then also laying out the
administration. That is unusual, I would say.
Yeah, I think so, while the secretary was in Texas. And then second, just because there have been reports emerging that the White House is sort of increasingly frustrated with Secretary Tillerson. And those came in conjunction, and that created the perfect little Washington rumor storm that everyone loves to follow. And it came out of that. But Rick Rimmer might have some other insights.
So I have no idea, but I think that it would not be it would seem like Nikki Haley would certainly be a contender to replace Rex Tillerson were he to go. I think that's for sure. She's clearly been more prominent. She's also clearly been more, while being, unfailingly supportive of the president and the president's agenda, she has been much more her own person, right? So she has stood firm on things that are not necessarily congruent with what you hear from Donald Trump. American leadership in the world, working with allies, sort of a number of things that like are pretty different from what you hear from Donald Trump. That stands her in good stead. She would, have a lot of support in the Senate and other places. The Iran thing is a separate issue from whether Rex is going away. But I would have to say that if you're having North Korea detonate a hydrogen bomb and fire off some ICBMs, and the Secretary of State is basically absent in sort of a where's Waldo, where's Rex situation. I mean, that certainly is good enough. I mean, it's perfectly reasonable for the parlor game rumors to be going on, because that's really pretty shocking.
Yeah. I mean, in the meantime, we still have all of these empty positions at State Department, senior positions. Have there been any movement on those?
I believe that one more Assistant Secretary of State name was put forth. I think last night it was don't quote me on this. I think it was for business and economic affairs.
What the department needs.
Yeah. I mean, I think from a lot of former and current state officials will say that a lot of the power lies within the regional bureaus, not the functional bureaus. So the East Asia, the Near East, the Western Hemispheres, more so than the, business and economic affairs or cultural and educational affairs, in terms of, diplomatic clout and influence around the world. And in that, we still don't have any new nominees. I believe the only one that's been nominated, while other names have been floated, the only one formally nominated is Wes Mitchell for Europe. And so I think that points to, that blame can't be placed on Rex Tillerson. It's the president himself who puts forth the nominees. So if, Rex Tillerson, might be responsible for some of the heat on that, because of course it's his job to pressure the president to get those names out there. But at the end of the day, it's the president himself. One thing that I should bring up is that Rex Tillerson, I don't think, gets enough credit for forging some pretty strong relations with key senators. He has a really close relationship with Senator Corker, who's the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee and backs him a lot on this redesign process. And so when those names are put forth and do come through, I think they can, some of these names can really sail through. I think there are a lot of senators on both sides of the aisle who want to see these key positions filled, because they know there's, some deafening silence coming out of the State Department right now that really undercuts U.S. diplomacy.
I think this is just malpractice at this point. I mean, it'd be one thing if they had a lot of they had key nominees up and Congress was slow rolling them and things like that. That's where you should be at this point. It should be true if you say Congress isn't approving my nominees. We've had some ambassadorial appointments made, like to India. There's been someone named. I don't think Victor Cha has yet been named as a nominee for South Korea. which would be great if he were. But if you think about it, if you figure the Middle East and Asia are where you have your biggest crises, including American soldiers in harm's way, we should have assistant secretaries for the Middle East and Asia at the Pentagon and the State Department. They should certainly have been nominated by now. And we should have an undersecretary for defense for policy, and we should have an undersecretary for political affairs at the State Department, and a bunch of these other positions as well. But like just at least those, you know, right now, the biggest crisis with North Korea any of us has seen is unfolding with no ambassador in our ally Seoul, no ambassador, although there's someone who's been named for Japan, no assistant secretary of state for the region, no assistant secretary of state of defense for the region. And those are the people who execute the policy of the United States. Those are the people who are in daily contact, who are making calls, who are saying, here's where we are today. This is what we're thinking. What do you guys think? Getting this feedback loop with partners about what we're doing in a crisis. And they have to be the president's people. They have to be, you know, right now the handicap is you can have some excellent people in an acting capacity, but counterparts don't know that they're really speaking on behalf of the White House and the president. And the people themselves are going to be careful because they have to figure out if they're, you know, where the policy is really going to be going. So you need to have your people in. And I would feel much more comfortable with picks that I wasn't fond of, but I would feel much more comfortable knowing that the right person is there who can call the people at the NSC, and they are there. They have staffed the White House. That they can call up and be like, okay, I'm calling the Koreans and saying this or that or the other, and how do you want to react to this proposal? That's your team, and not having this team in place is leaving a huge opening for Kim Jong-un. And a huge opening for our adversaries in the Middle East, for Assad and others. A huge opening for Vladimir Putin to fly around and sort of start deciding he's going to play the role of a peacemaker in Syria or on the Korean Peninsula. And I think it's doing lasting damage to the United States.
What is so striking for me about Rex Tillerson, and someone who has quite a good reputation or had quite a good reputation before coming into this job, is that he seems incredibly uncomfortable interacting with, speaking to, not just the press, but public. I mean, he's kept this almost cultivating this low profile. And when the State Department was pushing back on some of the bad press from the past week, there's suddenly this David Ignatius column in the Washington Post that touting him as the quiet diplomat. I guess it makes me wonder, I mean, the Secretary of State, you are the public face of the United States. Is it possible to be a low-profile Secretary of State and be effective? Because that seems to be what he wants to be, but it's almost a contradiction in title.
Yeah, the Ignatius piece was actually really interesting. It seemed to paint him as sort of this Kissingerian, you know, walk softly, carry a big stick, you know, real politic type Secretary of State. I think I hope this doesn't sound like a cop out, but maybe it's too early to tell what that impact will be. I was actually at an event earlier this week where Ambassador Pickering, Thomas Pickering, who's a, you know, one of the most distinguished American diplomats alive today, and I asked him, if you could grade Tillerson's performance in the first 8 months, you know, A to F, how would you grade it? And his answer was, what a foolish question, and I would be foolish to answer. And I think, you know, it points to, you know, there are a lot of people who are still cautiously optimistic or thinking, you know, the jury's still out and we're only 8 months in and we can't write the obituaries or the praise, you know, this soon into administration. But there are definitely others who have altering viewpoints.
I would just say this. If it had been a different Secretary of State, he might have still been careful, but Ambassador Pickering would have said something nice, not just said, I would be foolish to answer the question. So
praise, no
there's
praise.
No, you know, it's not hard to find something nice to say. So that's right. That actually to me is a pretty negative assessment coming out of Ambassador Pickering.
8 months,
he's the question is, I mean, so, you know, Henry Kissinger was not at all silent. He loved the limelight and was out there a lot in both his capacity as Secretary of State and Secretary and National Security Advisor. You know, I think Rex Tillerson, obviously, you know, he's probably doesn't think that that's a effective way to do business and wants to do things in private. And that might be a totally reasonable thing. He also, I think, knows that you don't want to end up on Time Magazine in the Trump administration. You want to make sure you're not stealing the limelight. And so he's probably chosen a low-key approach that is in line with his style, his leadership style, and with what he thinks the boss wants. But, you know, low key doesn't mean you can't, you know, issue statements, make even short appearances, you know, show up to talk to your staff and employees and embassies and places around the world, do some of the basic. I would imagine that a big corporation like ExxonMobil, you know, expects people want to see the boss. It's you're a leader. And it's so not doing those things is both internally harmful and, you know, and externally confusing. At least we're not in the situation where there's no briefings. I mean, at least there's a spokesperson for the State Department.
That's an improvement.
We spent months, and it's really stunning. We spent months having no State Department press briefing, something that is basically a daily thing for generations. The State Department speaks to the press on a daily basis. This is, you know, the fact that it took that long to get somebody in place is really stunning. So at least we have that, and I think you know, she's trying to do the best she can.
Yeah, and I think 2 points. First, on the press briefings, they aren't only for the press. There are a lot of countries who don't make the day-to-day news in FP or Washington Post or New York Times who look in statements from the press spokesperson on subtle signals and changes on, you know, a statement from the State Department press secretary on, say, Macedonia might not make big waves in Washington, but it's sure to make big waves back in Macedonia. And so it really has a lot of value beyond just, you know, press whining that they aren't getting them enough access. The second point on Tillerson being the former Exxon CEO is the State Department is the second place that Rex Tillerson has ever worked in his life. From college, he grew up, quote unquote, in the ExxonMobil world. And if you talk to anyone in the energy industry, you'll know that Exxon has a reputation of being incredibly quiet, incredibly behind the scenes, almost cultish and very, yes, very press averse. And so if you spend 40 years in this environment and suddenly have to become, you know, one of the most public prominent figures in the entire world, then, you know, I imagine there's a really jarring shock there that's really difficult to transition to. And also, you know, that really quiet, behind-the-scenes approach worked for ExxonMobil, and he turned it into arguably the most powerful and profitable company in the world. He's still maybe in that mindset at the State Department, and you know, it might work in some ways, and it might not in others.
I think the problem is ExxonMobil's job is to extract resources, and
that could be the Trump administration's.
It's got one. It could be. It's got one job. It's got one thing it needs to do, which mostly you do far away from people and out of sight is better. And you
hope
and you want to focus on safety and making sure no bad accidents happen and, you know, keep your reputation by keeping out of the news, basically. Whereas the nation's top diplomat has a very, very different mission, which is extraordinarily complex and involves every continent on Earth and involves every issue that faces the United States. You know, some of those might require being very quiet, like a secret back channel negotiation. But some of those, a lot of those, require articulating the policy and letting other countries know where we stand and letting the American people know what our approach is to a crisis, because we're a democracy and you let us know what you're doing when we're facing a nuclear war or sending our men and women into battle, because that's a responsibility you have to the citizens who elect you. And so if that's the case, it's not an appropriate way to run the Department of State.
Well, last question. Does Rex Tillerson make it to the year mark? We're at 8 months. Robbie, yes? No? Hard to say.
This is I'll caveat, this is pure speculation.
Absolutely. Well, that's
I think that Rex Tillerson strikes me as a person who likes to see a job through and has a lot of work ethic, very diligent. And I cannot imagine that if it were up to him, he would leave at least before the State Department redesign process is done.
Yeah, I have no idea, no way of saying. But as long as he's in this job, he should expect people to ask about how he's doing it and what he's doing. And I think he would serve himself well if he would share a little bit more.
Well, the great thing is we get to be around 4 months from now to see if he does make it to the one-year mark.
Indeed.
Again, ER nerds, we love hearing from you. If you have episode ideas or future podcasts, you can email us at erpodcast@foreignpolicy.com. Till next time.
Thanks.
You've been listening to Foreign Policies, the ER podcast. I'm Sharon Weinberger, and I've been your host. The program is produced by Katie Gardner and Brandon Martini. For more information about FP and to subscribe to the ER and our Global Thinkers and Backstory podcasts, please visit foreignpolicy.com, iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you very much for joining us.